future, Turkey will not get closer to becoming an EU member.
Earlier this week, the EU's foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, said Turkey isn't sending positive signals and needs to change its attitude fundamentally regarding the hydrocarbon dispute with EU members Greece and Cyprus in the Mediterranean Sea. European leaders say they will watch for Turkey's steps in the next couple of weeks before discussing any potential sanctions in their upcoming summit. Turkey is still a candidate to become an EU member. The bloc decided to effectively freeze accession talks in June 2018 over disagreements on accession terms. Many here are pessimistic about the future of accession talks, despite Ankara's ongoing efforts to meet the EU's demands. Meanwhile, some economists even warn that the accession could harm Turkey's economy. Reshan Saglam, Istanbul.
Israel launched airstrikes in the early hours of Sunday on the Gaza Strip, causing damage to surrounding areas, but no casualties reported. Israel claims the airstrikes targeted Hamas positions and came in response to a rocket fired from Gaza toward the southern city of Ashkelon, the second time in 2 weeks.
Israel is not committed to its responsibilities, refusing to allow in the required ventilators for the enclave amid the coronavirus pandemic. The resistance front preserves the right to give a crushing response to those violations.
The Palestinian groups say they will continue their resistance as long as Israel is imposing its crippling blockade over the impoverished enclave, especially amid the coronavirus pandemic and the shortage of medical equipment and ventilators.
It is the resistance movement's duty to defend Palestinians against the Israeli aggression under any condition. Israel should be held accountable for the deterioration of the Palestinians' lives. This is a crime against Gazans.
Observers say Israel's refusal to meet the basic needs of Palestinians increases the possibility of further escalation.
The ongoing conflict comes as a result of Israel's suffocating siege on the Gaza Strip over the past 14 years. Palestinians won't remain silent. Through strikes like the recent ones, Israel is seeking to cover up its internal problems.
Israel has been conducting similar strikes on Gaza Strip over the past months.
The resistance groups here stress they are ready for any possible escalation and the resistance will go on until the crippling siege on the Gaza Strip is broken. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
With almost 100,000 children under the age of 5 at risk of dying, Yemen slides into a dire situation. Here lies the 9-month-old Munir struggling to survive a severe malnutrition.
This is my son Munir. We've been here for a week. We want to treat him for malnutrition and God helps us. We're resisting this savage war.
The ongoing war and siege imposed by Saudi Arabia has brought a severe famine described by the UN as the worst humanitarian crisis in the world.
There is an increase in malnutrition cases. Yemeni children are suffering from malnutrition in all governorates, and we receive 50 to 60 cases per day. There is a shortage of medical equipment like CT scanners.
The UN's former humanitarian coordinator for Yemen described the country's food security status as catastrophic. Now, a UN analysis shows that the coronavirus pandemic, economic problems, and the war have pushed malnutrition the highest levels in some parts of the country. According to the UN study, malnutrition has risen 15% among children under the age of 5 this year.
We condemn and denounce the continued international silence about the blockade imposed on Yemen and the failure to take any measures against the Saudi coalition, which has exacerbated human suffering, especially for children.
Millions of children in Yemen could be pushed out of starvation by the end of the year as the humanitarian crisis is compounded by the ongoing war and the blockade, along with the pressure of funding shortage as the world grapples with the coronavirus pandemic. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
A large number of people turned up in the garrison city of Rawalpindi near Pakistani capital Islamabad. These angry youngsters were outraged against India over its alleged unending brutalities against Muslims in disputed Kashmir region. So were they resentful against Israel for suppressing Muslims in the occupied Palestine.
Equally, these protesters are angry with the rulers of many Arab states over their alleged collaboration with India and particularly with Israel in strengthening their illegal hold of territories belonging to the Muslims. But it seems for these protesters, there is a leadership vacuum in the Muslim world.
This protest was organized by Youth Parliament, an organization of students of colleges and universities from all over Pakistan. They have been campaigning to forge greater unity among Muslims across their racial and sectarian profiling and regions. With greater unity among the ranks and files of Muslims, these students are struggling to bring an end to the atrocities being committed against Muslims by reviving the true spirit of Muslim nationhood all over the Islamic world.
We will never accept Israel. They are bombarding on the small children in the Palestine. They are Muslims. We are standing with them and they are looking for the Pakistan, that they should come for the help for the Palestine.
The protesters sounded disappointed with the Prime Minister Imran Khan, who won last general elections partially with the pledge to pursue Muslim causes. Muslim causes in the world appears to be what matters to the common people in Pakistan. The lingering public resentment against France over repeated publication of blasphemous cartoons of the Prophet of Islam is yet another cause these students have been fighting for. This protest has followed gathering of millions of people on the streets of eastern city of Lahore a few days ago. Such a huge crowd emerged to attend the funeral of Khadim Hussain Rizvi, a religious and political leader who through his sustained protest forced Prime Minister Imran Khan last week to ink an agreement with his government to expel French ambassador and officially boycott French products in Pakistan. Javed Rana, Rawalpindi.
According to many independent institutions like Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commission, some Australian troops have committed crimes against humanity, such as intentionally killing civilians, since the beginning of America's longest war in Afghanistan back in 2001. A recent report on Australian forces' potential war crimes in Afghanistan has provoked reactions from Afghan institutions. Afghanistan's Human Rights Commission has condemned the killing of civilians by Australian troops and urged the prosecution of those responsible for the crimes. Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commission has dismissed as an inhuman move the killing of dozens of Afghan civilians by Australian troops. Unfortunately, Australian forces have brutally killed civilians, including men, women and children in Uruzgan province. In fact, it proves that the lives of the Afghan women, men and children have no human value or dignity for them. Unfortunately, 39 civilians were killed by Australian forces during their 11 years presence in Afghanistan. This comes as experts believe there is not much optimism that independent investigations would be launched, even at the International Criminal Court, into the case of killing of Afghan civilians by Australian troops.
Although grounds are available to probe the case by the International Criminal Court, interference and pressure by certain powers have created serious obstacles in the way of launching investigations into war crimes in Afghanistan.
Based on a recent report released by the United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan, more than 32,000 civilians were killed and around 60,000 others, including women and children, were injured over the last decade. That is why the UN body also believes it's time to put an end to this human tragedy and misery by struggling to bring peace to the war-ravaged country. Syed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Thousands in Paris, tens of thousands all over France are protesting for the second time in a week against the global security law. This new law has been voted in the French Parliament and makes it illegal to film and publish images of police officers. For these demonstrators, this new law is a violation of the right to inform.
We will no longer be able to film policemen in action and to put them on the social networks, which is of course very dangerous because nowadays there is a real issue in France about violence from the policemen.
Even at the very beginning of the sanitary crisis, with the total confinement, the police were controlling everybody, asking for their certificate to be able to leave their residence, you know, even though it could eventually be defendable from a sanitary point of view. Now, it has nothing to do with that. This proposed law is not directly connected to the sanitary crisis at all, and they are just giving more powers to the police.
Earlier this week, the police used tear gas and water cannon when protesters took the street in front of the French Parliament. With the new law, it will become illegal to film this kind of police intervention. During the Yellow Vest movement, videos have been used in judicial investigation concerning police violence. With this law, the French state can more easily hide illegal actions committed by police officers. It can also more easily hide scandals, which opens the door for abuse of power.
For us, this law doesn't only concern journalists. During the Yellow Vest movement, we have seen an explosion of police violence. One of the important arms to fight against this is the ability to film the police violence and to denounce it. So this law is also against us, not only against journalists. There is also a surveillance of demonstrators by drones.
The French government says they want a better protection for their police force. But the new French law is seriously criticized by the Human Rights Council of the United Nations, as well as by a large spectrum of the French civil society, journalist associations, trade unions, political parties, and human rights defenders. 1 year of prison and 45,000 euros of penalties, that's what someone risks for publishing the face of a police officer. Many people here say that the French government is using the coronavirus crisis to limit personal and public liberties. Chris Den Hond, Paris.
The U.S. presidential election remains unresolved, but what seems crystal clear is that the nation is more divided at any time than since the 1960s, or perhaps even the 1860s. A new poll found that nearly 80% of America says they are deeply divided on its most foundational values. Whoever is inaugurated in January will face a deeply mistrustful and disbelieving public. As the poll also finds that just 30% of Americans believe the country will grow more united in 2021. For a nation which is the richest in the world and which faces no serious external threat, such levels of disharmony are shocking even to many Americans themselves.
The far right, that's really come from almost like Trumpism, if that movement still stays strong, we can see more conflict in the next 4 years. And I think it's really just dependent on how Joe Biden kind of handles the next 4 years, and also what kind of information is really getting flown out of the far right and whether that gets filtered or not or whether that gets spread very rapidly.
Distrust is not something which grows overnight. Many attribute the division to the American liberals' obsession with so-called identity politics, which divides and redivides people into smaller and smaller tribes based on gender, race, ethnicity, urban, rural, coastal, inland, and on and on. U.S. conservatives are criticized for having a limited view of unity due to an us versus them mentality, which leaves little room for change or modernization.
Right. I think that Republicans and Democrats have become almost like their own tribes where they're not willing to give an inch to the other. I hope that's not going to continue. And I hope that the rhetoric becomes less incendiary as we move forward. But I don't think that Trump is doing anything but fomenting more discontent among groups of people that are already tribalized and having a hard time getting together.
The United States is proving unable to resolve a host of enormous problems. Protecting from the coronavirus pandemic, Great Depression era levels of unemployment alongside a skyrocketing Wall Street, endemic economic inequality which has exploded in 2020, constant racial discrimination, record disharmony between genders, a Congress which is half as popular as an often deeply unpopular president, and of course, a disputed election, the third in six tries. The poll makes it clear that belief in the nation's division is not a partisan issue, as Democrats, Republicans, and Independents all agree in similar proportions. Americans can only seem to agree on one thing, that they really, deeply disagree. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on November 3, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference on the occasion of the birthday anniversaries of the Holy Prophet of Islam and Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq. Greetings be upon them. And which coincides this year with the National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance and Unity Week. Imam's great initiative in naming Unity Week.
As for Unity Week, today, more than ever, the importance of Imam's initiative has become clear. Many officials in Islamic countries did not understand how important the message was. In other words, they tended to ignore it because of their various ulterior motives. However, today we understand how important the message was. The events that have taken place today, the various differences that exist among Islamic countries, and the horrible incidents that have taken place in some regional countries, including in Syria, in Iraq, and at a certain point in time in Libya, in Yemen, and in Afghanistan, help us understand how important the unity of the world of Islam was and how precious the solidarity of the Islamic Ummah was as announced and demanded by Imam Khomeini. If that unity had existed, many of these incidents would not have occurred. What exists in the world of Islam today, particularly in a certain part of it in the region, is really disastrous. They undermine the issue of Palestine. They have made the treacherous and despicable move to normalize their relations with the Zionists. All these are the outcomes of lack of unity in the world of Islam.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Me faith to be stronger among others.
For the sake of appearances and based on corrupt and false motives, such an indecent act was committed, which culminated in the violation of the Palestinian nation's rights at the hands of certain people. Of course, the Palestinian cause cannot end, and they're too small to be able to put an end to this matter. The Palestinian cause will continue to thrive. Palestine will become Palestine. And the Zionist regime will be destroyed. There is no doubt about this. However, they are creating obstacles on the way of this cause, within the scope of their capabilities. One of the things that they have done is to establish relations with that murderous and criminal usurper, the Zionist regime.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee, so recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
the debate.
Iran's leader has spoken and has described the illegal sanctions the United States has imposed on Iran with the support of its European partners as a, quote, bitter reality and a crime against the nation. And in terms of the Europeans, he has said that they are constantly adopting positions against Iran, like on Iran's defensive missiles. This is while Britain, France, and Germany possess destructive nuclear missiles themselves. In this debate, we will ask our guest how the Europeans can interfere in Iran by making such a request, and whether the incoming U.S. administration, once confirmed, will adopt the same policy. Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate, university lecturer and author Daniel Kobalik, joins us from Pittsburgh, and director of the Risalat Strategic Studies Institute, Sam Tarabi, joins us from Qom. I'd like to welcome both of you. Sam Tarabi, I'm going to start with you. Iran's leader has said that legal sanctions in the United States that has been imposed on Iran with the support of its European partners, calling it a bitter reality and a crime against the nation. Your reaction to that first, please.
Well, I think, you know, it's pretty obvious that this is the reality and that it is a crime. And if you just look at the amount of people that have suffered over the years, it's not a recent thing. It's been going on for 40 years now because of the sanctions. And now, particularly after we saw during the corona and the COVID epidemic, you know, these are statements, these are facts that I don't think really require us to need to prove them or that require some sort of a long discussion. These are the realities, these are the facts. I think what's more important is the fact that the leader in this speech and in previous speeches has pointed out to some of the basic strategic issues that are behind the scenes of these policies, of these inhumane policies that the Westerners, whether it's the Americans or the Europeans, are pursuing. And it goes to the heart of the matter, which is that they don't want Iran to be a powerful country. And they don't want Iran to take its place as the natural hegemon in West Asia and to displace America and to displace those countries in the various spheres of countries where they have spheres of influence. For example, France in Lebanon or Syria, you know, Britain in some of the Gulf, Persian Gulf states, or Jordan. So this is about real politics. This is about real power. And, you know, the fact that the Europeans are duplicitous, hypocritic, don't, you know, act on their word is not something we need to really spend a lot of time discussing. It's a reality and a fact that's been proven over the centuries.
Okay, so our guest there, Daniel Kobalik, talks about the latter half of what he said is what I'd like to elaborate on with you. I mean, we know what the sanctions have done. We know that the U.S. has exerted, as our guest there said, sanctions for decades now. And that has hurt ordinary Iranians. But in the respects and the vantage point of it preventing Iran from becoming a regional power in the region that it's in, do you think that that is one of the aims that the U.S. has had, even though it has backfired, because Iran has subscribed without having the choice into domestically producing and improving its capabilities in a whole host of fields? But do you think that that was one of the aims or remains one of the aims of the U.S. and perhaps its partners to limit Iran's capabilities?
Yes, of course. I mean, we have to start with the premise that the U.S. Wants hegemonic control over every region of the world. It believes it has control over the Persian Gulf, that it has a right to such control. Remember the Carter Doctrine? Jimmy Carter said the U.S. had the right to militarily intervene in the Persian Gulf whenever it felt its oil interests there were threatened. I mean, it's literally called the Persian Gulf, right? It could just be called the Iranian Gulf. And yet the U.S. thinks it should have hegemony there. The same thing in the South China Sea. It resents that China has any, you know, say over what happens in the South China Sea. It's absurd. But yes, that is the U.S. goal, is to limit any power in any part of the world that can challenge the U.S. in that region. And Iran really is the only country standing in the Middle East, because the U.S., of course, has destroyed most of the others, that can contest U.S. hegemony. And so we see, for example, that Benjamin Netanyahu, of course, a close ally with the United States, just had this so-called secret meeting. It's not secret anymore, in Saudi Arabia to, you know, form an alliance, an anti-Iranian alliance with Saudi Arabia. It's all part of the plan, and the U.S. is going to support that plan. And I don't care if it's Biden or Trump who's in charge. That will be the U.S. policy. The U.S. has never forgiven Iran for overthrowing the Shah in 1979. And you know, it will continue to harass that country.
All right, let's talk about the incoming U.S. administration, once confirmed, Sam Tarabi. I mean, we just heard from the president-elect Joe Biden speaking just before our program, in which he introduced some of the members of his team. Now, Iran's leader has said on the nuclear deal, of course, we tried the path of having the sanctions lifted once and negotiated for several years to that effect, but it produced no results. Now, that is due to Trump pulling out of the JCPOA. How do you think Iran is going to deal with this incoming administration? Do you think that it's going to trust the other side, namely the U.S., to go ahead with another deal, if even that scenario is being contemplated by Iran, were it to be approached?
First of all, let's remember that before the Trump administration and before Trump pulling out of the deal, we had the Obama administration not implementing the JCPOA. And the proof of that is, at that time, you had the head of the Iranian Central Bank going to their annual IMF meeting in the U.S., in Washington, and publicly and in English declaring that the results of the JCPOA for Iran have been nothing. He literally said the word nothing. So it's not just the fact that the Trump administration pulled out. The JCPOA itself, even at the time of the Obama administration, was not being implemented by the United States. So let's just get the facts and the history right. And the fact that then Trump pulled out, of course, that then means that there is no agreement in terms of, you know, the main party that Iran was trying to negotiate with. So the reality of the fact is that after Yani, with the coming of the Biden administration, Iran has already officially declared, as stated by Dr. Zarif, the foreign minister, that U.S. needs to compensate Iran monetarily for all the damages that it's done. Obviously, the Biden administration is not going to go for that. So it seems to me that there are very clear barriers towards anything resembling anything that was previous to that. That's number one. Number two, as you may recall, on the day of the election, when the Supreme Leader had a speech, he very clearly stated that it makes no difference who the president is and what the administration in the U.S. is. Our policy, that, in other words, Iran's policies and strategy towards the U.S. are very clear, and it makes no difference whether it's Trump or Biden. As you may recall, at the beginning of this whole process, because you quoted the leader, what he said today, in terms of we tried to lift the sanctions or to relieve the sanctions through negotiations, and it didn't work. Well, let's go back to the beginning of this whole process, when the Supreme Leader at that time said that, go ahead, negotiate, I am pessimistic, this shall be an experience for all of us. So now we've had this experience. We went into the process with goodwill. We stood by all our agreements. None of the other sides fulfilled their part, neither the Americans nor the Europeans. And so now I think it's, bordering on the silly and on the mentally, you know, unstable to be talking about going into another round of negotiations with whoever it is.
Okay, but it's being talked about, and Daniel Kovalik, Iran's leader, has said, in terms of the Europeans, France, Germany, and the UK, he's questioning how they can even talk about having Iran put its missile defense capabilities on the negotiating table when they themselves didn't follow through with their commitments to the JCPOA. And, of course, we're looking again at an incoming U.S. administration, once confirmed, that there's been lots of noise about how they may be approaching Iran in terms of the JCPOA. How do you think this is all going to pan out?
Look, I think ultimately the West is going to continue to harass Iran, but Iran is going to continue to do what it needs to do, which frankly it has the right under international law to do, and that is defend itself. I think we learned after the Libya debacle, in which Muammar Gaddafi had agreed to give up any nuclear ambitions, right, to be returned to the fold, so to speak, with the West. He was repaid with an invasion that ended in his brutal murder. The lesson there is you don't give up your defenses. The lesson is the West is not a fair and honest negotiator. You have to do what you do, what you have to do to defend yourself. And North Korea has learned that as well. So Iran will continue to defend itself. It will continue to find allies in countries like China and Russia. And the West will be unhappy, but they'll have to live with it.
Assad Torabi, you talked about how Iran's leader has said that it doesn't make a difference who sits at the White House. Iran is going to go its route, pretty much. Now, I'm going to use Iran's leader's statement here and see what you think of the issue of sanctions. In terms of how he addressed it, he said, quote, "If we manage to overcome the sanctions through our own efforts and initiatives while holding firm against the problems, the other side will gradually lift the bans since it will see their ineffectiveness." Is it correct to interpret this as that there's going to be some kind of engagement then, since the other side, once seeing the sanctions is not working, will gradually lift them, as he has said?
Why are we so insistent on engagement? I mean, you know, the definition of somebody stupid is somebody who keeps doing something and gets the same results. So we've been engaging for 20 years without strategic deterrence. I'm emphasizing the point that my colleague was making. Iran has to develop a strategic deterrence. The Europeans and the Americans have to know that Iran will come to negotiations if it so chooses in its own interest with having strategic deterrence. Strategic deterrence means having missiles, having a strategic navy. The one news item, which unfortunately I don't know why we don't report it enough, is that for the first time this week, the Revolutionary Guards officially declared that we have ICBM capabilities. We have intercontinental ballistic missile capability. It's the first time that that SEPA has announced this officially. So this is something that is important. The lesson of the last 20 years of engagements with the West is first have the missiles, then go talk about whatever you want to talk about. This is the mistake that the establishment in Iran has made for the last 20 years. They thought that they are dealing with their cousins, that they're going to sit there and have some sort of an agreement, and that those civilized, so-called civilized Westerners, which the Supreme Leader has called terrorists in suits, perfumed terrorists in suits, this is what the Supreme Leader calls them, that they are going to somehow stick to their deal, and John Kerry's word has some sort of credibility and all that stuff that we listened to for the last 10 years under this administration in Iran. And the reality is that that's never going to happen, because they don't consider Iranians to be equal human beings. They consider it their natural right to be dominating our region. They consider it a right that France controls Syria and Lebanon. They consider it their right that Britain controls the Persian Gulf states and Jordan. So the idea that, the one nation in this region that is the natural hegemon of the region, I repeat this, I know some people in Iran don't like me to say that, but the reality, if you look at the history of West Asia, is that Iran is the natural hegemon. It's been even declared as such by American strategic thinkers, if you look at the documents during the Nixon administration, as an example. If you look at all the documents that have been declassified over the decades, the Americans, the West, they themselves know that Iran is the natural hegemon, and all of this goes back to the idea that you have to starve Iranians so that they will stop, taking their rightful place in history and in this region. And there is no way of somehow coming to an agreement about this. Either the U.S. is the hegemon or Iran is the hegemon. There is nothing in between. There's no such thing as having some sort of a peaceful coexistence with the U.S., with the Zionist apartheid state of Israel, or with the medieval dictatorships of Saudi Arabia and the Emirates. We have one country in this region that has a constitutional republic, and it's called the Islamic Republic of Iran. It's the one country that actually has a constitutional and a republican form where you have elections where different parties and different views come and compete, and you have different governments coming to power and with different views. You have elected parliament, you have elected local councils. Of course this is a threat to the Saudis. Of course this is a threat to the Emirates. Of course it's a threat to the Israelis, who are occupying, you know, more people on their land than they themselves, the Zionists, are. So these are the realities, and instead of us, you know, repeating some of the ways that the debates are framed in the West, let's talk about this, what it is all about. It's about Iran being a model for the countries of the region, for the Muslim world, of a country who is able to develop itself independently, to form a healthy and a vibrant political domestic scene, to form and to establish its power, as is its right, as is the right of any nation, and to be independent of foreign influence. This is what it's all about. And it's not going to happen with the Americans or the British or the French, you know, allowing us to happen. We have to get it ourselves, and that's what we're doing, and that's what they're fighting us about.
And that's what Daniel Kovalik, the U.S., doesn't want, along with its allies, especially Saudi Arabia and Israel. What do you think they will do to stop Iran, as they have said, in their words, interfering in other regional countries' affairs, and to stop Iran overall from being the power that it is in the region?
Well, obviously the worst-case scenario would be that they would try to militarily assault Iran. And I fear that that is a possibility. I think that that has been on the table for a long time. Seymour Hersh, the journalist, has done some great work on that, you know, saying that there have been plans to attack Iran for some time. I think, you know, every time the U.S. has gotten close to doing it, it's gotten cold feet, because Iran is a very strong country, very populous country that knows how to defend itself. It proved that in the war with Iraq. But I do fear that that's still on the table. And look at what the U.S. has done to countries like Iraq, like Syria, like Libya. They have destabilized them to the point that they are failed states, largely. And if they could do that to Iran, they would. Let's face it, they would probably do worse. And so, sadly, that is a possibility. I think any decent person should oppose that. Americans have to oppose that. They have to oppose our government doing that. But I do think that that is a possibility.
And finally and quickly, Sam Tarabi, just recently it was revealed that Trump was contemplating attacking Iran's nuclear facilities. Do you think that that is going to be the all options on the table scenario, going to be what the incoming U.S. administration will also follow through with?
The one single fact over the last decades, especially after the war, after the Iran-Iraq war, is that the U.S. knows that if it attacks Iran, it will be the end of its presence in West Asia. This is the reason why they didn't attack Iran after Iran attacked the Ain al-Assad and the Erbil bases. So this is actually one of those things that is said a lot, especially in the West. But the reality is that actually an attack on Iran is something that would be to the strategic advantage of Iran, because it would then allow us to legitimately and legally attack all American interests in the region, which is ultimately what has to be done eventually to get the Americans out. The Americans are not going to leave on their own accord. The Americans leave places when their soldiers are taken out in coffins and body bags. That's how the Americans leave places. And this is going to be the case in West Asia as well. And unfortunately, what happens in domestic American and in Western media, which then also influences Iranian media, is that there's always talk of, well, you know, if Bernie Sanders comes, this is going to happen. If Biden comes, this is going to happen. It's not going to happen. There's no administration and nobody who is going to become president who has the capability of withdrawing even 500 or 1,000 troops from certain places, because it's not the president who decides these things.
I do apologize for that. That does it for this edition of The Debate. University lecturer and author Daniel Kovalik with the statements, and director of the Rasalat Strategic Studies Institute, Sam Tarabi. Thank you for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Vitali, the entire team in the capital of Tehran, it's goodbye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM. Amir Kabir. Khayyam. Maulana. Avicenna. Khwarizmi. Iranian notables, sources of global honor.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, in this episode, you'll get more familiar with the Iranian poet who lived in 7th and 8th centuries AH, corresponding to 13th and 14th centuries AD. He was Seyf Faraghani. Seyf Faraghani has been known as a leader of socio-political poetry in Farsi language. The 7th and 8th centuries AH were among the bright eras of Iran's literary history, as masters of poetry and Gnosticism like Maulana, Saadi, and Hafez lived in that era. Thank you. During the Mongol invasion, some regions in Iran remained intact against the pillage and destruction imposed by the invaders. This was mainly due to the wisdom of the local rulers. For instance, Fars region remained safe because it was under the rule of Sa'd ibn Zangi, Abu Bakr and his sons. They were Solgori rulers who used to consort with the men of letters and were sponsors of artists and poets. Thus, the rule in the region coincided with thriving of knowledge and literature. Therefore, when Genghis Khan and Hulagu attacked the region, the entire region remained safe and secure, and as a safe haven, attracted a group of notables of the era as well. The acclaimed poet Saadi Shirazi has composed poems on the situation of the region in those days. Shams Ghais Razi, too, has explained his wandering in Khorasan and Iraq and asking the help of the great figures of Fars. He explains in details the efforts of Sa'd ibn Zangi's son for development and security of the region and the welfare of the people. The words of Shams Ghais do show that the Fars region and the ports and islands of the Persian Gulf were the examples of development, security, and flourishing during the Solgori rule. Another region that remained intact against the Mongol invasion was Asia Minor, which mainly consists of the current Turkey. This region was ruled by Seljuks as powerful kings. The Mongols managed to overcome them only when they had become too weak. In view of this, Asia Minor used to function as a refuge for many scholars and learned from Iran. Many elites had covered one city after another to reach the region to live in security. Among these figures, mention can be made of paragons of the Farsi literature like Jalaluddin Muhammad Molavi or Maulana, Shams Tabrizi, Saifuddin Faraghani, and others. Each of these men was a great personality in mysticism and poetry. With regards to the fact that many of these migrants were Iranian thinkers, poets, and scholars, they took a lot of books with themselves, hence the Iranian culture and Farsi language were transferred to their region. Sham, or Greater Syria, and Egypt were other places that remained immune against the Mongol and even Tartar invasion. Thus, many great scholars migrated to the region and stayed there till the end of their life. The region beyond the Indus River, or Sindh, was another important safe haven for Iran's scholars and literary men. This region was under the rule of Ghur dynasty at that time. It soon turned into an important base of Farsi literature and Iranian sciences. The Ghur rulers were divided into the emirs of Sindh, emirs of Delhi, and emirs of Bengal. They had mainly been trained with Iranian culture. There was a big group of Iranians among the emirs of India who had either migrated to the region a little before the Mongol onslaught or concurrent with the events of Transoxiana and Khorasan. Nuruddin Muhammad Ofi was among the renowned Iranian poets who escaped from the Tartar onslaught to Sindh. Apart from these regions that were mentioned, there were other places where Iranian great men would gather, but we will not touch upon them. Dear listeners, next time we will continue the discussion.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.